A little after sundown, Falcon crossed a railroad track. The depot was a small, red-painted wooden building surrounded by a wide plank platform. A white sign with the black letters Medora identified the little town. Three freight cars sat on one of the sidings, and a large wheeled baggage cart was tucked up against the side of the depot. Falcon crossed 3rd Avenue, then seeing a livery down at the corner of 3rd Avenue and 6th Street, turned south. When he stopped in front of the livery, he was greeted by Chance Ingram, the owner of the business.
That's a good-looking horse you have there, mister.
Thank you.
You looking to board him?
Yeah. Give him some oats tonight, and a good rub down. Clean straw in his stable.
I'll do it. Horse like this one needs good treatment. Glad to see you do right by him. This your first time in Medora?
Yeah. Where can a man get a good meal?
Well, ordinarily I say Bessie's Cafe, but she went over to Posey to help her sister birth a baby, so her place is closed for a few days. Only other places to eat are Ma Perkins' boarding house and Golden Spur Saloon. But Ma Perkins only sets one table for supper, and like as not, she's done fed.
Well, the Golden Spur it is.
Ed cooked up ham yesterday. I think he's still feeding off of it. It ain't bad. I had some myself for lunch.
Thanks.
Falcon snaked the rifle from the saddle holster, then tossed his saddlebags over his shoulder. He headed down the street. He didn't have to ask where the Golden Spur was. It was the largest and most brightly lit building in town. Pushing through the batwing doors, Falcon stepped to one side, placing his back against the wall and taking himself out of silhouette from the street. He wasn't on the run from the law right now, nor did he have any known enemies at the moment, but a lifetime of caution governed his behavior. With his saddlebags draped over one shoulder, the butt of his rifle on the floor, and his left hand holding it just behind the sight so that it was kicked out a little way, Falcon studied the saloon. Such establishments had become a part and parcel of his being, and his life was defined by the saloons, liveries, and false-fronted streets of the dusty cow towns he had been in over the years. He couldn't deny these places without denying his own existence. He had already put the last town out of his mind, and he had no idea where he would go next. He was here, now, and that was all that mattered. The saloon was full. No more than half a dozen of the patrons looked up at him. Most looked toward him only to see if they knew him, and seeing they didn't, he turned to what they were doing. Several bar girls flitted about the room like bees going from flower to flower. Heavily made up and garishly dressed, they were using their charms to push drinks. Toward the back of the room, Falcon saw a table so small that it could accommodate only two chairs. The table was empty, perhaps because it made no allowances for socializing. Since Falcon was more interested in getting something to eat than in socializing, the table was ideal for him. A young woman came over to his table. Although she was a very pretty girl, her modest dress, the hair pulled back into a severe bun, and lack of makeup told Falcon that she wasn't one of the bar girls. She wiped the table with the towel she had draped across her shoulder.
What'll it be?
The livery man told me you had a pretty good ham. Any of it left?
Yes, sir, there's a mite left.
Good. You got any beans?
Yes, sir. Ham, beans, greens, and cornbread.
Cornbread any good?
I hope to say it is. I made it myself.
You made it yourself, huh? And just who would you be?
My name's Ella.
All right, then, Ella, fix me up a plate. And two beers. One now to kill the thirst, and the other to enjoy with my dinner.
Yes, sir.
Ella hurried back to the kitchen to prepare his order. As she passed the bar, she said something to the bartender. He nodded, drew a beer, then held the mug up toward Falcon. Falcon walked over to get it.
You're visiting Medora, or you're just passing through?
I haven't made up my mind yet.
Well, now, if you ain't the dandy.
Leave him alone, Muley. He ain't done nothing to bother you.
The way he looks bothers me. Tell me, Mr. Easton, how come you didn't buy yourself a whole pair of glasses?
Turning his head, Falcon saw a couple of rough-looking cowboys accosting someone. The recipient of the jibes was a young man wearing an Eastern-style suit, complete with jacket and vest. He was standing at the bar, staring straight ahead, trying to avoid his antagonists.
Look at them funny-looking little glasses, Zeb. They ain't got nothing to wrap around the ears. How the hell you think he keeps him on?
You think a man would own the ranch?
Mr. Teddy Roosevelt owns 2 ranches, from what I've heard.
Oh, 2 ranches? You think a man what own 2 ranches could afford a whole pair of glasses instead of them things that's just pinching the end of his nose like that?
Roosevelt took the glasses from his nose and held them out.
Interesting you would make that observation. Because, you see, that is exactly how they are held on. That's why these are called pince-nez glasses, which means pinched nose. I guess you aren't as dumb as you look after all.
Don't get funny with me, Tenderfoot. I'll knock them stupid-looking glasses off in your ugly face.
Josh Andrews, one of Roosevelt's cowboys, chimed in.
You fellas got no call to be ragging Mr. Roosevelt like that. Lay off it.
Who do you fellows ride for?
Ain't none of your business who we ride for, Four Eyes.
They ride for Mr. Montgomery, over at Two Rivers Ranch.
Well, I know Don Montgomery. He's a decent and upright man. I can't imagine he would have anyone working for him who wasn't of good stuff. I'm sorry we seem to have gotten off on the wrong foot. Suppose you two lads have a few drinks on me. Barman, if you would, provide these gentlemen with libations of their choice. I will pay. Oh, and you can set up another round for my cowboys as well.
Thank you, Mr. Roosevelt. Come on, boys, belly up. Muley, you and Zeb, too. Have a drink.
What about you, Mr. Roosevelt? Another lemonade?
Yes, thank you.
Muley and Zeb collected their shots, and the situation was eased.
Sir, I got your supper here.
Falcon followed Ella back to his table.
Thank you, Ella. What'd they call that fella at the bar, Roosevelt?
Yes.
He's from the East?
Yes, from New York.
What's he doing out here?
Well, he owns a ranch out here, but that's not why he's here. He's here because his mama and his wife both died on the same day, and he needed to just get away from them. Isn't that just about the saddest thing you ever heard?
Yeah.
Falcon looked at Roosevelt and realized that even from the back, he could see the young man's grief. Roosevelt stood at the bar, looking neither left nor right, and not participating in conversation with his men.
He's out of place out here. A dandy like that is going to be eaten alive by men like those two there.
Well, they are a bad sort, all right. I hope you like the cornbread.
Falcon took a bite, then closed his eyes.
Mm-hmm. This might just be about the best cornbread I ever tasted.
Ella smiled and waved her hand dismissively, though it was obvious she was pleased by his compliment. She went on back into the kitchen. Falcon began eating then, and had just cut a piece of ham when he saw Muley and Zeb behind Roosevelt. Both had menacing scowls on their faces, and Zeb was picking up a bar stool. It was plain to see that they intended to repay their benefactor for his generosity with a violent attack. Normally, Falcon didn't like to mix it up in other people's fights, especially a barroom brawl. But he knew that the Eastern dude wouldn't stand a chance against these two. And as far as Falcon could tell, he had done nothing to deserve such treatment. Quietly, Falcon pushed his chair back from the table and stood up. He started toward the bar.
Hey, you ass-kissing posy. We aim to bash in your head and have us them funny-looking glasses.
To Falcon's surprise, Roosevelt made no effort to avoid the assault. Instead, he turned to meet it head-on, and from nowhere, it seemed, Roosevelt's left arm jabbed out and his fist caught Muley right on the tip of his chin. Muley went down, just as Zeb, who was carrying the bar stool, raised it over his own head, intending to bring it crashing down on Roosevelt. Roosevelt sent 2 quick left jabs into Zeb, snapping his head back and causing him to drop the stool. Roosevelt followed with a hard right to Zeb's jaw. Zeb wound up on the floor with Muley. Sensing Falcon's approach, Roosevelt whirled to meet him, taking up the stance of a boxer with his fists raised.
Hold on there, Mr. Roosevelt. I'm not attacking, I was coming over to help. Although it's pretty clear that you don't need any.
You were coming to defend me?
Well, that was what I had in mind. Sort of foolish of me, huh?
I was a boxer in college. Perhaps I should have mentioned that to these two gentlemen before they undertook their little adventure. Had I told them, they may not have been so incautious.
Oh, I think they had it in their mind to take you on no matter what.
You called me by name. I know you.
Nope. My name's McAllister, Falcon McAllister.
Falcon extended his hand and Roosevelt gripped it firm.
McAllister. There are a couple of actors in New York named McAllister.
Yep, Andrew and Roseanne.
Yes, I believe that is their name. I'm not much for the theater, but they are so popular, everyone in the city knows of them. Even those of us who do not follow the theater. I'm not sure if they are husband and wife, or...
They're twins, actually.
You seem to know a good deal about them.
I should. I'm their brother.
You don't say. My, what an interesting coincidence. Won't you join my friends and me, Mr. McAllister?
Thank you very much for the invitation, but I'm just having myself.
Then enjoy your dinner, my friend.
During the conversation, Muley and Zeb had staggered to their feet and, rubbing their jaws, slunk out of the saloon. Falcon returned to the table and finished his dinner. When he asked for the bill, he learned that Roosevelt had already paid for it. He was also told that any drinks he ordered for the rest of the night would be paid for by Roosevelt. Glancing up, he saw that Roosevelt was looking toward him. Smiling, Roosevelt touched his eyebrow in a salute. Falcon nodded his thanks back to him. At that moment, Muley and Zeb stepped back into the saloon. Both men were holding pistols. Neither saw Falcon rise from the table, his own gun in hand. Muley went down with a bullet in his shoulder, Zeb with a bullet through his hand. Though neither wound was life-threatening, they caused both men to drop their guns. It all happened so fast that for the first few seconds, only Muley, Zeb, and Falcon knew what had happened. Everyone else in the saloon spun around in surprise at the sound of the guns. But it didn't take long for them to piece it together, as they saw Falcon standing there with smoke curling up from his gun while Muley and Zeb's pistols were both on the floor. Muley rose and stood there for a moment, holding his hand over his shoulder wound, while Zeb held his left hand over the wound in his right. Sheriff John Dennis came into the saloon then, drawn there by the sound of gunfire. As it happened, he arrived even before the smoke from the discharges had rolled away.
What the hell happened here?
I'll tell you what happened. This here son of a bitch shot me and Zeb for no reason at all.
That's right, sir. He didn't have no call to do what he done.
Why are your guns on the floor instead of in your holster?
They're on the floor because, well, he started in a shooting at us. What was we supposed to do? Just stand there and let him do it?
Yeah, what were we supposed to do? Just stand here with our thumb up our ass and let him do it?
Falcon put his pistol back in his holster and sat down. Using a piece of cornbread, he raked some beans onto the tines of the fork. It was his studied indifference to what was going on that both fascinated and frustrated the sheriff.
You got anything to say, mister?
Yeah. This is good cornbread.
You know what I'm talking about, mister. This here shooting, did you do it?
Oh, hell, I did it in front of the whole saloon. It'd be kind of hard for me to say I didn't do it.
So you're saying it happened just like Muley said?
Sort of like he said. There's a few differences. Like, I didn't just open up on them. They both had their guns drawn, and they were about to shoot Mr. Roosevelt.
Is that your story? That they was about to shoot Mr. Roosevelt?
Yep. That's my story.
Well, looks to me like we got us a little situation here. Two of you are telling one story, one is telling another. So that's 2-1 against you, mister.
Sheriff Dennis, I would like to make that 2-2.
I beg your pardon.
It happened just the way this gentleman said it did. I saw it all. Those two men there were going to kill Mr. Roosevelt, and they would have too if this gentleman hadn't stopped them.
Make that 3-2, John, because I also seen it.
You seen it too, did you, Ed?
I did.
You want to tell me what it is you saw?
The big fella there is telling the truth. Those two was about to shoot Mr. Roosevelt. Would have too if he hadn't stopped them. The thing is, he could have killed them both. Instead, he just nicked them up a bit.
Well now, boys. Looks like things has turned a mite against you.
Yeah, well, we wasn't aiming to kill Roosevelt or anything like that. All we was going to do was have a little fun with him. We wasn't really going to shoot him, was we, Zeb?
That's right. We wasn't really going to shoot him. We was just going to scare him.
So, you see, that fella had no right to shoot us like he done. I demand that you arrest him.
I'm not gonna do any such thing. You admit that you two was coming after Mr. Roosevelt with your guns drawn. How was anyone to know that you didn't plan to kill him? Fact is, I believe you did intend to kill him, but was stopped by being shot.
The sheriff paused for a moment and stroked his chin as he studied the two men.
The problem is, I can't prove what you planned to do, only what you done. And you didn't do anything because that man stopped you before you could do it. So I got no choice but to let you go.
We're pretty near bleeding to death here, and you ain't doing nothing to the man who shot us.
That's right. So my advice to you is to get yourself down to the dock and let him patch you up.
Well, gentlemen, once more I am obliged to buy a round of libation, this time in celebration of my rescue from certain death.
In the embalming room of the funeral home, Emil Prufrock looked up from his work when two men entered the room. On the embalming table in front of him was the body of an elderly woman. Quickly, he pulled a sheet up over her.
Gentlemen, visitors aren't allowed back here.
Why not?
Out of respect for the deceased.
Well, she's dead. She don't know we're here.
Then, let us say out of respect for the bereaved. Please, if you have business with me, let's conduct it in the front.
Prufrock ushered them from the embalming room to the front parlor.
Now, what can I do for you?
My name's Creed Howard. This here's Bob Howard. Where at is our brother?
Your brother?
Thad Howard. He got himself hung here a few weeks ago. By the time me and Bob found out about it, it was too late. So where at have you put him?
Oh, yes. Well, your brother was an indigent.
No, he wasn't. He was white.
An indigent. A person without means. He was buried at public expense, so that means he is in Potter's Field.
Where's that?
The cemetery is at the south end of town. Potter's Field is at the back of the cemetery.
I hope you spelled his name right on the marker.
I'm afraid there is no marker.
What do you mean there ain't no marker? How can you bury a man without putting a marker on his grave? How can anyone find him?
As I explained to you, your brother was an indigent. The county will pay to have the body interred, but that is, as far as it goes, no marker.
It ain't right that he don't have a marker.
If you would like to pay for a marker, I will put one up for you.
Yeah!
Well, how much does a marker cost?
You can get a very nice marker for $10.
$10?
Yes, that would be a very nice one, with a rose carved into the marker, and a nice sentiment.
Yeah, we'll need all that crap. What's the cheapest one got on it?
It has nothing but his name, date of birth, and the date of his death.
Well, I don't know the date of his birth. You, Bob?
Nope.
So don't put nothing on it but his name. How much that cost?
$2.
Creed and Bob stepped over into a corner to discuss it between themselves for a moment. Then they came back.
So, have you gentlemen decided what you want on your brother's grave marker?
Yeah. We decided he don't need one. Tell us where his grave is at and we'll just go up and look at him.
Yes, well, here is a chart of the cemetery.
Prufrock pointed to a chart on the wall. He put his finger on one spot.
Your brother is buried here, in the last row, third from the end.
Without so much as a word of thanks, Creed and Bob left the undertaker's parlor. Creed and Bob walked the cemetery with a lantern, looking for their brother's plot.
You think we should have paid to get a marker put up?
What for? Hell, he's dead, ain't he? He won't know one way or the other. And I can think of a lot of better ways to spend $2.
Yeah. Thinking of one right now.
Come on, Creed, we're in a graveyard. Have a little goddamn respect.
Well, shit, I'm sorry.
Reaching Thad's grave, they stood there for a moment, looking down at it.
Think we ought to say some words?
I got nothing to say.
Me neither. Yeah, let's go have us a few beers.
Barkeep! Two beers! Hey, what in the hell's up with all that construction going on at the jail?
You mean you didn't hear about all the excitement we had here a few weeks ago?
All we heard was that you hung a fella named Howard.
Oh, yeah, that would be Thad Howard. Well, he was hung on the same day the jail got dynamited.
The bartender began telling the story, aided by a couple of nearby patrons. That was when Creed and Bob heard Falcon McAllister's name for the first time.
You say McAllister fought off them train robbers, brought in Thad to be hung, and took the bank robbers beside? What is he, one-man army?
Some might say that he is. Others might think he's just a man who seems to find himself in areas where trouble breaks out.
Where is he now, this McAllister fella, I mean?
I don't know. When he left here, I don't think he had any particular place in mind.
He's in Medora.
Medora? How do you know that?
I was there myself a couple days ago, and I seen him shoot the guns out of the hands of two men who were about to shoot Mr. Roosevelt.
Roosevelt? Who's Roosevelt?
He's some fella from the east who owns a ranch over near Medora.
And you say that McAllister is over there?
He was when I left.
Bob nodded. Then he and Creed took their beers over to a table where they could talk more privately.
What you got in mind, Bob?
Maybe a little revenge.
Oh, wait a minute. You planning on going after this McAllister fella?
Yeah.
You heard what they said about him. And we know for a fact that he single-handed took out Rufus, Buddy, and Curly. Thad told us that, remember? The thing is, he didn't know the fella's name at the time.
Yeah. He sounds like a one-man army, all right.
And knowing all that, you still planning to go after him?
Maybe we can get some help.
Get some help? From who? What are you talking about?
You heard what the man said about McAllister shooting the guns out of the hands of two men over in Medora?
Yeah, well, I don't know that I believe him about that. Shooting a gun out of someone's hand. That's pretty much tall tale.
Maybe. But something must have happened. And if we could find the fellas it happened to, they might be interested in a little revenge of their own.
Zeb Kingsley and Muley Simpson were nursing drinks and their anger in a little ramshackle saloon in the tiny settlement of Puxico. It was a small settlement with no more than a handful of low-built chinked log buildings. A sign out front of the saloon read, "Whiskey, Beer, Food, Goods." Inside, the building was dimly lit and cross-shot with sun bars of gleaming dust motes that pushed in through the dirty window and the cracks between the logs. There were three other customers inside the building, two leaning on their elbows and nursing rot-gut whiskey, the other one sitting at a rough-hewn table with Zeb and Muley. A young woman was on her hands and knees with a bucket of soapy water and a brush, scrubbing the floor.
Mr. Montgomery didn't have no right to fire us like he done, McGee. I mean, when Deacon's got all stoved up when he got throwed while he was breaking horses, why Montgomery didn't fire him? So what if we can't work a few days while we're on the mend? He didn't have no right firing our asses like that.
Yeah, well, he didn't fire us because we got hurt. He fired us because we jerked a cinch into that Eastern dude. And all the ranch owners stick together, you know that. They all stick together so the cowboys have to work for practically nothing.
Practically nothing is better than nothing at all. Nothing at all is what we got now.
Aaron Childers, Dalton Yerby, and Percy Shaw pulled back the canvas flap and entered the saloon. The young woman looked up from her scrubbing when they came in and brushed an errant tendril of hair back from her face. The bartender moved down to greet the three men when they stepped up to the bar.
There's something I can do for you, gents.
Beer and some to eat.
Yeah, you got money to pay for it?
Yeah, we got money. What, you get a lot of folks coming in here buying things without money, do you?
Oh, no, not a lot, but we do get them from time to time. And often enough that I like to see the color of money before I put anything in front of anyone.
Well, by God, mister, you got some sand treating your customers like that.
Well, you ain't my customers till you spend money. And I ain't seen no money.
Well, listen, you son of a bitch.
Hold on, Percy. The man's running a business here. He has every right to ask whether or not we got money.
This rather accommodating position was something new for Aaron, and both Percy and Dalton looked at him curiously.
The truth is, mister, me and my partners is running into a bit of bad luck. We got money, but we ain't got a lot of what you call cash money.
Well then, your luck ain't getting no better, because cash money is the only kind of money there is.
But we've got a couple of fine horses out front we'd be willing to sell.
This ain't a livery.
Two good horses with saddles.
Huh. Are these horses stolen?
They ain't stole. One of them belonged to my brother. The other one belonged to Dalton's brother. They was killed, both of them.
How?
I don't reckon that's none of your business how they was killed. The point is, these here horses ain't stole. So if you'd like to buy them, we can make you a good price.
I'll take a look at them.
While you're looking, we'll be drinking. Give us three beers.
The bartender took their three nickels, then drew the beers and set them before the trio. When he went outside, Aaron turned his back to the bar and, drinking his beer, listened in on the conversation of the men at the table.
What'd you say this fella's name was?
Aaron saw that the man who asked the question was big, with long hair and a full bushy beard. The man he was questioning had a soiled bandage on his right hand.
His name was Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, but the dandified son of a bitch calls himself Teddy.
Dandified?
Well, yeah, he wears fancy clothes and these funny-looking little glasses that sort of just set on his nose. He's from back east somewhere.
Yeah? Well, he may be some dandy from the east, but I hear tell he handled you and Muley pretty good.
Me and Muley was caught by surprise, weren't we, Muley?
Yeah, and by the time me and Zeb figured out what was happening, why, he had some hired gun shooting at us. He shot me through the shoulder and shot Zeb through the hand.
This here fellow Roosevelt has him a hired gun, does he?
That's what it looked like to me. The fella that shot us is a big fella with sandy hair and blue eyes.
Up until that point, Aaron had been listening with only half an interest. But the man Muley described sounded a hell of a lot like Falcon McAllister. He wondered if it was the same person. Percy interrupted Aaron's musings.
Hey, Aaron, what do you say that after we sell them horses, we get us a whore?
Yeah, let's get us a whore.
You see any whores around?
What about her?
Percy pointed at the woman who was still on her hands and knees scrubbing the floor.
She don't look like no whore to me. Looks like a cleaning woman to me.
Well, she's a woman, isn't she?
Percy smiled at the woman, who the whole time she was scrubbing had been glancing up toward the three.
I'll give you $20 apiece for the horses.
How much for the saddles?
Well, that includes the saddles.
The saddles are worth that much without the horses.
You think you can get more for them? Ask someone else.
All right. Any of you gents want to buy a horse and saddle?
Not me.
Zeb and Muley shook their heads as well. Aaron nodded toward the men standing at the end of the bar.
What about you two? You want to buy a couple of horses and saddles? $60 will get you both horses and saddles. What is it? What's so damn funny?
I doubt that either one of those boys have ever even seen $60.
All right. I'll take your damn $40.
I thought you might come around and see things my way. Now, what can I get for you?
What do you got to eat?
Biscuits, bacon, beans.
That'll do. We'll be over there.
Aaron pointed at the only other table.
Hey, bartender. What about that woman over there?
What do you mean? What about her?
Well, is she your wife or something?
She's just the woman that works here.
It's all she does is scrub the floors and such?
She does a little more than that.
Oh, does she whore?
She whores some.
How much?
You have to take that up with her.
Percy went over to talk to the woman while Aaron and Dalton found the table next to the table where Zeb and Muley were sitting.
Hey! What's your name, woman?
Millie.
The woman raised up on her knees and looked up at Percy, again brushing a strand of hair back from her face. It was dirty water on her hand, and it left a smear. She smiled, showing a mouth empty of teeth. Then, obviously self-conscious about it, she covered her mouth with her hand.
Well, Mary, the bartender said you whore some. Is that true?
Mm-hmm. I'll whore if the price is right, and if I happen to take a fancy to the man.
Well, what about me? Do you take a fancy to me?
You'll do.
Look at old Percy over there strutting his stuff. If he ain't the little rooster in the hen house, though.
Shh! I want to listen in on what these fellas over at the next table's talking about.
What for?
You can pick up a lot of information by keeping your ears open and your mouth shut.
Percy sauntered over to the table.
She said she'd do it for a dollar.
Is that a dollar piece, or will she do us both for $1?
Well, I don't know. I didn't ask her about you.
Well, go find out.
Oh, what the hell? You go find out.
Uh-uh. You're the one she likes. If she's going to do it, it will be because she's taking a shine to you.
Yeah, she does like me. You can tell, huh? All right, I'll go ask her.
Percy walked back over to the woman.
Will you do me and my friend for a dollar?
What? You mean at the same time?
Same time? Well, no, not at the same time. I'll be first, then my friend.
Why should I do both of you for $1?
Oh, come on, Millie. Well, look at yourself. Without them teeth, you ain't exactly what somebody would call a pretty woman. Hell, you think you'd be grateful for any man that paid any attention to you at all. So what the hell happened to them teeth anyway?
A drunken cowboy knocked them out.
Well, shit, me and Dalton wouldn't do something like that. All we want is a little poke, that's all. But we don't want to pay no more than a dollar for it. You think about it, it's more than you got now. And it's got to be better than being on your hands and knees scrubbing the floor.
Millie looked over toward the table, toward Aaron and Dalton.
I'll do two of you for a dollar, but I won't do all three of you.
Well, that's all right. Aaron, he don't want to do it anyhow. It'll just be me and old Dalton.
I got a room in the back.
As Millie began taking off her apron, Percy hurried back to the table.
She'll do it both for a dollar.
How'd you get her to do it?
I told her that with them teeth knocked out, she wasn't going to be able to do no better.
You do know how to talk pretty to a girl.
Yeah, I always did have me away with women. Come on, let's go.
What about her food?
Oh, I had me some food just yesterday. I ain't had me no cooter since I can remember when.
Yeah, you got a point. The food will still be here when we get back. What about you, Aaron?
You boys have your fun. I ain't interested.
As Percy and Dalton followed Millie into the back of the saloon, Aaron turned his attention to the conversation of the men at the adjoining table.
What's this fella Roosevelt doing out here anyway?
He owns Elkhorn.
Elkhorn? That's a ranch?
It ain't just a ranch. It's a big ranch, biggest in the county.
Owns a ranch, huh? Well, they say most of the ranches now is owned by rich men from the east who never even seen the land. At least this Roosevelt feller's come out here to run his ranch. Or maybe he ain't as rich as all them other ranch owners.
The hell he ain't. He's rich, all right. And they say he carries more money on him than most folks will ever see in a lifetime.
Why would he do that? Carry so much money, I mean.
He likes to be the big man. Comes into town, pays cash for all his supplies, and then he goes over to the saloon and starts buying drinks for everyone. He's got everyone eating sugar cubes from his hand. If you want to know the truth, I think that's why the son of a bitch pisses me off.
Why is that, Muley? Did you miss out on your turn at the sugar tit?
You can laugh if you want. I just don't care for the son of a bitch.
Percy and Dalton came back to the table, their faces flushed, but each of them was wearing a big grin.
You should have been with us, Aaron. It was good. Oh, it was real good.
Come on. We got to go.
Go? What do you mean we've got to go? Me and Percy ain't even it yet.
You had your chance. You chose to go with the washerwoman. Now we got things to do. Let's go.
Just what is it we got to do that's so damn important we can't even eat?
I just figured out an easy way for us to get a lot of money.
It was early morning when the Empire State Limited from New York backed into Chicago's Union Station. Even the squealing of the train as it came to a stop didn't awaken Anna Heckmeyer.
Miss Heckmeyer? Miss Heckmeyer, ma'am, the train has arrived at the station.
Anna opened one eye.
Miss Heckmeyer?
Awakening slowly, Anna raised herself up on one elbow and pulled the shade aside to look through the window. Another train was just a few feet away, separated from hers by a narrow brick-paved walkway that was crowded with detraining passengers. The passengers were walking swiftly toward the main station through wisps of steam that drifted out to tease them.
Miss Heckmeyer?
Yes. Yes, I'm awake.
You have only 30 minutes to change trains, Miss Heckmeyer. If you'd like, I'll get a station porter to take your luggage for you now.
Wait. Give me about 10 minutes to get dressed.
Yes, ma'am. But you'd best not tarry none. The train you'll be wanting will leave at 8 o'clock sharp.
I'll be ready.
Getting up from her bunk, Anna walked over to the little lavatory and poured water into the basin. As she washed her face and brushed her teeth, her image stared back at her from the mirror. Arrogantly beautiful was the way her dear friend Gail had once described her. Anna had just completed 4 years of schooling at the New York Conservatory for Young Women. During the previous summer vacation, she had gone to Europe on a continental tour as part of her overall education. She was headed back home now for the first time in over 2 years, and she was anxious to see her father again. Anna's mother had died when she was 5 years old, so long ago that Anna's memories of her were manifested in bits and pieces. The smell of cinnamon and flour, the feel of her skin when she embraced Anna, and the look of the sun in her hair. Anna's father, Judge Andrew Heckmeyer, had not remarried, so he had taken on the responsibility of being both mother and father to his daughter. For that reason, Anna had missed him even more and was anxious to get back home. By hurrying, Anna was dressed within 10 minutes after the first call. She opened the door to her compartment and looked out into the aisle. She saw the porter standing out on the vestibule, looking out over the station.
Porter?
Yes, ma'am?
I'm ready now. Would you see to my luggage, please?
Yes, ma'am.
20 minutes later, Anna was on the Northwest Flyer, leaving Chicago for Points West. She would not have to change trains again until she got off in Medora, Dakota Territory. Settled into her new compartment, Anna took out the last letter she had received from her father and began to read.
I am most anxious for you to meet Mr. Theodore Roosevelt of New York. Mr. Roosevelt owns Elkhorn Ranch near here, and is a man of considerable wealth and, so I am told, political influence back in New York. But all the wealth and influence in the world could not prevent a terrible tragedy from befalling him. For his wife and mother died on the same day. He is an engaging man, and we have enjoyed many interesting conversations, but it is clear to see that the sorrow of his loss is just beneath the surface. I think you might be just the one to cheer him up. At least I hope so. It isn't good that a man like Mr. Roosevelt be so immersed in sorrow.
Anna had inquired among her friends to see if any of them were familiar with Theodore Roosevelt. She was surprised by just how many people did know of him, and even more surprised to hear that not a one had anything bad to say about him. That, more than anything else, intrigued her. She found herself looking forward to meeting Mr. Roosevelt. After a few days' rest in Medora, enjoying a real bed to sleep in and meals he didn't have to cook for himself, Falcon went out again in search of the men who had killed the Douglases. The recent rains had washed away any of the original tracks, but when he ran across a fresh set, he got down from Diablo for a closer examination. This was what he'd been looking for. When Falcon followed him from the Douglas Ranch, he had been trailing 5 horses, 3 carrying riders, 2 with empty saddles. What he saw now was the track of 3 horses, all of which were carrying riders. He didn't know what happened to the other 2 horses, but he was certain that at least 2 of these horses were the ones he had originally been tracking. One of the horses had a nicked shoe on the right hind foot. One of the other horses led with his left forefoot. These tracks fit that pattern. In addition, a nearby horse dropping was still fresh.
They're close, Diablo. Real close.
Falcon mounted Diablo and rode ahead. The trail led into a low-lying range of mountains. That was good, because they could only go where the mountains would let them go. Falcon was even closer than he thought. For less than 3 miles ahead, Childers, Yerby, and Shaw were discussing their upcoming operation.
What makes you think this here Roosevelt fella will be carrying a lot of money on him?
'Cause he's rich. Not just flush, I mean really rich. And he'll be riding into town today to pay for supplies for his ranch. Whenever he goes to town, he also goes into the saloon, where he puts on the big dog by buying drinks for everyone. They say he carries a roll of money around that's big enough to choke a horse.
How do you know all this?
Why, you boys was betting that ugly girl back at the trading post. I was listening in on the talk at the other table. Why, robbing him will be as easy as taking money from a baby.
Yeah? Well, that bank was supposed to be easy, too. And look what happened. We didn't get no money, and we wound up getting my brother killed.
He didn't get killed robbing the bank. That didn't happen until later. Besides, my brother was killed too, if you remember.
Yeah, but you didn't like your brother.
That ain't true. I liked Frank all right. Him and me had the same ma. It was Corey I didn't like.
Yeah? Well, that don't change the fact that they was caught and was almost hung when we tried to rob that bank. And for all that, we didn't get practically nothing at all from the bank.
Well, let me ask you this. Did you know the clerk couldn't open the safe?
No.
Then how the hell was I supposed to know?
Let's quit jawing about the bank and think about the money we're going to take off of this here Roosevelt.
Yeah, that's what I say. There ain't no sense in crying over spilt milk.
Where do you want to hit him?
Well, according to what them fellas back at the trading post was saying, his ranch is right on the other side of that range that's just ahead of us. That means that whenever he goes to town, he's going to have to come right through that draw there. Look up there at them rocks about halfway up the wall. We'll be waiting up there. Soon as he comes in, we'll open up on him.
When will it come?
Today's Saturday, ain't it?
Yeah?
He comes into town every Saturday.
Whoa. Roosevelt took off his hat and wiped the sweat from his forehead with a big red bandana. He looked at the bandana and chuckled.
If the people back in New York could see me now, sweating like a dock hand, carrying this tablecloth of a bandana, I tell you, they would have a laugh.
Roosevelt knew that talking to his horse was only slightly above talking to himself, but it was a habit he had developed recently. The long, lonely rides were necessary for him to work out the grief, but often he felt the need to express himself verbally, and the only way to do that was to talk to his horse.
You are a good listener. About the only one I've ever spoken to who wasn't just waiting patiently for his own time to talk.
Putting his hat back on his head, he leaned over to retrieve his canteen. Even though Roosevelt was an accomplished horseman, he was in an awkward position when the horses bolted. Because of that, he was unseated. Roosevelt was being shot at, and he knew it. He wasn't wearing a pistol, but he had a rifle in his saddle sheath. Even as he realized that, though, he saw his horse moving away from him.
Whoa, horse!
The horse paused for a moment, and Roosevelt was nearly to it. For a moment, Roosevelt stood there looking at the fleeing horse. He was unarmed and defenseless. He had no choice but to run toward a nearby ridge where he could take cover. Falcon had heard the shots and saw Roosevelt running toward the ridge. Turning his gaze up the wall of the draw, he saw a little puff of smoke drifting away from a rock outcrop. Falcon snaked out his rifle, jacked a round into the chamber, and snapped off a shot. Reaching the ridge line where Roosevelt had taken cover, Falcon leaped from his horse. He slapped Diablo on the rump to get him out of danger, then fired again at the rocks halfway up the wall.
You all right?
Yes. Thank you.
I wasn't able to offer you much help the other day. Looks like you could use it this time.
Yes, indeed. There is something to be said for persistence. If at first you don't succeed in offering to help, try again.
Falcon raised his head to look up toward the rocks. He saw three men moving quickly up a path toward the top of the cliff. He'd not yet seen the men he was trailing, so he couldn't identify them on sight. But he would have bet cash money these were the same three. He raised his rifle and aimed at one of them.
Please, don't shoot him.
Why the hell not? I've been trailing these sons of bitches for a couple of weeks now, and they just tried to kill you.
Yes, but I'm in no danger now, thanks to you.
Mr. Roosevelt, you don't know what these men have done.
No, but if you shoot them now, I know what you would be doing. You would be acting as their judge, jury, and executioner. I don't think you really want to do that now, do you?
All right. You win.
Thank you.
Any idea why they were after you?
Oh, yes. I'm quite sure they wanted to rob me.
You carry enough money with you to attempt a robbery?
I have about $1,000 on me now.
He produced a roll of money to show Falcon.
Put that away. Damn, mister. Don't you have any more sense than to go flashing around that much money? You're unarmed. How do you know I won't take it?
I may still be learning about the West, but I am quite skilled in reading people. I know you won't take it.
Well, you're right. I won't. But some people can fool you, so you should be more careful.
Oh, indeed. I will be more careful from now on. Thank you.
Your horse ran away. If I can run mine down, I'll go see if I can find him for you.
Thank you, but that won't be necessary.
What the hell? How'd you do that?
Believe me, it is a necessary skill when summoning a hack in New York City. If you'll wait here, I'll recover your horse for you.
Well, thank you.
Under the circumstances, it is the least I can do.
A piece of cake, you said. Some Eastern dude that carries a lot of money. All we have to do is shoot him, then take the money, you said. Well, we listen to you and that McAllister person shows up, we damn near got ourselves killed.
Dalton, you'd bitch if you was hung with a new rope.
What are you laughing at?
You'd bitch if you was hung with a new rope. That's funny.
There ain't nothing funny about getting hung, new rope or no. In case you don't remember, Corey and Ethan was near about hung. And if we'd have been caught, why, we'd all hung. Because there wouldn't have been anyone to get us out the way we done for Ethan and Corey.
Well, why do you reckon that McAllister fella's after us? Is he a lawman?
He ain't no lawman, that's for sure.
Fact is, I've heard there's paper out on him. Whoever kills him will get a reward.
Oh, you don't say. How much of a reward?
Believe me, whatever it is, it ain't enough.
Yeah. Well, I don't know much about him, but I'll say this. That son of a bitch can shoot from the gallop. He pure near put a bullet through my head. And if you want to know the truth, I've had about a belly full of him.
So what are we going to do now?
What do you mean, what are we going to do now?
About money. We bowed out of the money we got from selling them horses. And now we're so broke that if piss pots was a dime a dozen, all we could do is shout, ain't that cheap?
Now I'll come up with something.
Yeah? What?
I don't know. I have to think about it for a while.
Now there's something to look forward to. You were thinking. So far there ain't nothing you've come up with that's worth the plugged nickel.
On board the Northwest Flyer, Anna Heckmeyer was writing in her journal.
I had nearly forgotten how lovely it is out here. As I look out towards Painted Canyon, the play of light and color across the face of this wild and beautiful country nearly makes me forget the crowded streets of New York. And as exciting as New York was, this wonderful and wild West is even more exciting. Geologists will tell us that centuries of wind and water have shaped this magnificent land, adding depth and contrast to define its character. But as I view it through a scattering of wind-twisted cedars and junipers, ensnared by the colors and awed by the clarity of the light, I clearly see the hand of God.
Welcome home, Miss Heckmeyer.
The conductor had stopped at Anna's commodious and comfortable seat in the Wagner parlor car.
Well, hello, John. When did you get on the train?
At Bismarck. I miss seeing you. How long has it been now?
4 years. Though I did get home 2 years ago.
You were back east somewhere, weren't you?
Yes. I went to school in New York.
And how was it?
It was wonderful. And I'm sure it was all worthwhile. but I must confess I'm very happy to be back.
What seating do you want for lunch?
I'm in no hurry. I'll take the third seating.
Very well. I'll take care of it, then.
Anna watched the conductor move through the car to get the seating preferences from the other passengers. John Norton had been a conductor on the Northern Pacific for as long as Anna could remember. He'd been there to provide help to Anna and her father when they traveled to Bismarck for shopping expeditions. And he had been there 4 years ago when Anna took the train east to finish her education in New York. In his office, Judge Heckmeyer sat and conferred with Teddy Roosevelt.
If we want to continue to elect Republicans, we are going to have to get some more of the Western territories in as states. It's the only way to counterbalance the Democratic South.
That's all well and good, Andrew, but we as a party can't afford to just turn our back on the other states. Take my own state of New York, for example. It went Democratic for the most recent election, but I know we can get it back into our column. Though I'm not sure we have put forth the best candidate in James G. Blaine.
What about your own future, Teddy? Have you plans?
I don't know. At one time, I was entertaining various plans. Mayor of New York, governor, the U.S. Congress, or Senate, maybe. But I have burned a few bridges with my steadfast support of John Edmunds at the convention in Chicago. I was completely shut out of Blaine's campaign.
Maybe that isn't such a bad thing.
How so?
Well, if Blaine is as corrupt as you say he is, then some of that corruption may rub off on some of his supporters and advisors. If you're out of the picture, you will be clean.
You may have a point. At any rate, since my Alice died, it all seems inconsequential. I've rather lost interest in politics, and politics has lost interest in me.
Nonsense. You're a good man, Teddy, and the nation can always use a good man.
Speaking of a good man, I have recently had two encounters with someone who is my idea of the true Western hero.
You don't say. Well, who is this man who has so captured your imagination?
His name is McAllister. Falcon McAllister.
Falcon McAllister, you say?
Yes. Do you know him?
I know him.
From the way you are reacting to his name, I take it that you don't agree with my assessment of the gentleman.
Believe me, he's no gentleman. And you're correct. I don't agree with your assessment.
Is there something about him I should know?
Well, for one thing, he is too quick to use the gun. He was a passenger on a train when the train was stopped and boarded by train robbers. Instead of remaining quiet like the other passengers, McAllister engaged them in a gun battle, killing three of them. And despite all that, one of the robbers managed to get away with the money.
You fault him for trying?
Yes, I fault him for trying. The gun battle took place inside the train, in the midst of passengers.
Heavens! Did he wound or kill any of the passengers?
In fact, two passengers were killed, though the statements of the other passengers said that they were killed by the robbers before the gun battle ensued.
Then isn't it possible that Mr. McAllister prevented more passengers from being killed?
It is possible, though it is just sheer luck that more weren't killed in the shootout. I told you about the case that I tried in Belfield, the bank robbery and murder?
Yes.
Falcon McAllister happened to be in town when the bank was robbed, and he turned the town into a shooting gallery by shooting at the robbers as they were fleeing. He is reckless and irresponsible.
Did he hit any of the bank robbers?
Yes. He shot two of them from their saddles, and when another dismounted to see to them, McAllister subdued him as well.
So, for resisting a bank robbery attempt and for stopping three of them, you say he is reckless and irresponsible.
I do indeed.
But wasn't he just doing his civic duty?
Two men were killed as the result of that shootout. Sheriff Billy Puckett and an innocent bystander. As it turns out, it wasn't McAllister's bullets that killed either of them, but I'm convinced that had he not opened fire like that, those two men would still be alive.
I suppose there is that possibility. But it would seem to me that you are stretching the possibility to reach the conclusion.
The man is a killer.
If by defending himself he has killed, then I could believe that. But if you are calling him a killer by nature, I do not believe that. I'm sorry, but I cannot believe ill of someone who saved my life.
You say McAllister saved your life? How did he do that?
Yesterday, when I was riding into town, I was set upon by a band of outlaws. Their first shot startled my horse, and I was unseated. I suddenly found myself dismounted without a weapon of any sort, and being shot at by three armed and desperate men.
That's a hell of a situation to be in. What did you do?
I ran to a nearby ridge to seek cover.
But I knew that wouldn't help, because once they discovered I was unarmed, there would be nothing to prevent them from just coming toward me as bold as you please, killing me and relieving me of my money.
Teddy, I've told you before, and I will tell you again, you shouldn't make it a practice to go about with so much money. This is a far cry from the civilized streets of New York.
I know, I really should be more careful. But I guess the man upstairs was looking out for me that day, because he sent someone to my rescue.
Falcon McAllister.
Yes. He appeared out of the blue, and, with a few well-aimed shots, soon sent my attackers on the way.
He appeared from out of the blue, you say?
Yes. Just when things were most desperate, there he was.
Did he kill any of them?
No, he just shot at them, and evidently came close enough to convince them that killing and robbing me wasn't going to be as easy as they thought. Why did you ask that?
From time to time, I have warrants transmitted to me, authorizing the immediate arrest and incarceration of Falcon McAllister for aggravated manslaughter. Invariably, those warrants are withdrawn within a few weeks after they're issued. According to the documents that request the withdrawal, it is because new information has come to light suggesting that the manslaughter incidents have all been justifiable homicides.
If the homicides are justifiable, why are you so hard on him?
Because I don't believe anybody can find themselves enmeshed in that many justifiable homicides, unless he is actively seeking the opportunity to, as you describe, suddenly appear out of the blue. His bold and reckless activity in Belfield bears me out on that. However, having said that, I must confess that I am glad that he was there to save your life.
Even so, that hasn't changed your opinion of him, has it?
I'm afraid not. But you do have the advantage over me in that you have seen him in one of these life-and-death situations, so you are better able to judge his actions than I am.
Roosevelt thought back to the incident in question. Falcon McAllister had raised his rifle and aimed at one of his assailants, even as they were withdrawn. Had it not been for Roosevelt's interference, at least one of the outlaws would have been dead at Falcon's hand. And though the death would have no doubt been ruled justifiable homicide, it wasn't actually needed to save his life.
What is it?
I beg your pardon?
You were thinking about something just now.
It was nothing.
No, I think it was something. What happened when McAllister intervened on your behalf?
Nothing happened, other than the fact that Mr. McAllister drove away the outlaws.
Roosevelt thought of, but did not voice, the fact that he had pulled Falcon's arm down to prevent him from shooting one of the outlaws as they were leaving.
Teddy, you are the consummate politician. Something did happen, you just don't want to tell me.
And you are the consummate jurist, always looking for more than you are told.
At that moment, Judge Heckmeyer's law clerk stuck his head into the room.
Excuse me, Judge.
Yes?
We just received a telegram from the sheriff at Sentinel Butte. They're ready to hold the trial.
I thought the defense counsel asked for another week.
Yes, but he withdrew the request and is now asking that the trial be conducted immediately.
Stroking his chin, the judge stared at Teddy Roosevelt for a moment. His daughter was supposed to arrive on the afternoon train. If he left this morning for Sentinel Butte, he wouldn't be here to meet her train. He had the authority to postpone the trial until the originally agreed-upon date. But on the other hand, what better and more natural opportunity was there for him to arrange a meeting between Roosevelt and his daughter?
Judge?
Oh, tell them I'll be there, of course.
Very good, sir.
Teddy, I wonder if you could do a favor for me.
Yes, I'd be glad to. Anything you ask.
You know about my daughter, Anna, who has been away in school?
Yes, you showed me her picture. She is a lovely young woman.
Thank you. I think so as well, though I admit that it may be a father's prejudice. At any rate, she is arriving on the 3 o'clock train this afternoon. Would you be so kind as to meet her and make certain that she and her luggage reach the house safely?
Yes, I would be delighted to do that for you. But suppose I don't recognize her?
You will. I may be a doting father, but I can tell you without hesitation to simply look for the most beautiful woman to leave the train.
The arrival of a train in Medora was always an event. Trains brought mail and newspapers from the east, fresh produce from the south, and people from all over. And in doing so, connected the small town with the rest of the world. As a result, there were generally many more people gathered on the depot platform than there were people who had a legitimate reason for meeting the train. As Teddy Roosevelt sat in the back seat of the roofless carriage, waiting for the train to arrive, he stuck his hand down into a small paper bag and pulled out a piece of whorehound candy. Popping a piece into his mouth, he handed the bag forward, offering some to his driver.
Candy, Willie?
Thank you, Mr. Roosevelt. Don't mind if I do.
A liveried and dignified-looking black man stuck his own hand down into the bag.
Willie, have you ever heard of a man by the name of Falcon McAllister?
Why, yes, sir. I reckon just about everyone's heard of the McAllisters.
The McAllisters? You mean there is more than one?
There's lots of them. I don't exactly know how many. I do know they're one of the families that opened up the West.
And Falcon McAllister is one of that bunch?
Yes, sir. Fact is, except for maybe his pa, he's the most rip-snorting of them all.
What do you think of him?
I think maybe he wouldn't be a man I'd want as an enemy.
Is that a fact?
Yes, sir, that is a fact. On the other hand, anyone that can call him a friend is a lucky man.
I've only met him twice, but I think I could call him a friend.
That makes you a lucky man, Mr. Roosevelt. But if you don't mind me saying so, that cuts both ways.
I beg your pardon?
Mr. McAllister can call himself a lucky man, too, for having you as a friend.
Why, thank you, Willie. Thank you very much. And I hope that you include yourself in that number, for I consider you to be a friend.
Yes, I'm proud to say that I do.
The Northwest Flyer was arriving right on schedule. Roosevelt stepped down from the carriage and walked across the wooden platform to stand next to the track. Roosevelt watched the joyful reunions and tearful departures with a sense of melancholy. He felt both a part of it and apart from it, for he was himself a traveler, out of time and place here in the West. And yet, he did not think he would be able to cope with the grief that was still just beneath the surface. He did not have this wonderful country in which to lose himself. Anna stepped down. A cloud of smoke drifted by, caught by the wind, and swirled down to tickle her nose with its acrid odor. Nearly all steam locomotives were burning coal now instead of wood, and the smoke had a distinct, much less pleasant smell than the aroma of burning wood from the earlier engines. Anna fanned some of the smoke away from her face as she looked out at the crowd, anxiously trying to locate her father. A large smile of eager expectation spread across her face as she prepared for the long-anticipated reunion. But her smile faded when a thorough perusal of the crowd disclosed the fact that her father wasn't there. She knew that she'd informed him of the exact date and time of her arrival. An unreasonable fear began to creep over her that something had happened to him. It wasn't hard for Roosevelt to locate which of the departing passengers was Anna Heckmeyer. She was the only arriving passenger who was a young, unaccompanied woman. However, even if that had not been the case, he was sure he would have been able to recognize her by her father's description. The young woman who stood on the platform, anxiously searching through the crowd, had long, auburn hair, large brown eyes framed by full lashes, high cheekbones and full lips. Clearly, she was an exceptionally beautiful woman. Roosevelt started toward her, picking his way through the crowd. From the way the young girl's eyes were moving, he knew that she was looking for her father, so he hurried his pace in order to relieve her of any unnecessary worry. He doffed his hat as he approached.
Miss Heckmeyer?
Yes?
Your father asked me to meet you when your train arrived.
Oh, is something wrong?
No, no, please, put your mind at ease. Your father has a trial in Sentinel Butte, that's all. I realize that I am a poor surrogate, but under the circumstances, I am honored and pleased to offer my services to you. My name is Theodore Roosevelt, though my friends all call me Teddy.
Oh, yes. I've heard a great deal about you, Mr. Roosevelt. A great deal indeed.
Have you now? My word, that is rather unexpected, I must say. May I inquire as to how you have heard about me?
I have heard of you from both my father, who speaks very highly of you, by the way, and from some of your friends back in New York.
Is it too much for me to hope that my friends back in New York share your father's opinion?
That isn't at all too much to hope for. In fact, all of the reports have been quite laudatory.
Bully for my friend. Bully, I say. Would you like to wait for your luggage? Or would you prefer to come with me now and leave your luggage to be collected later?
I will come with you now.
Anything Willie should know about your luggage?
No. I'm sure the station officials will recognize it and keep it safe until your man can call for it.
Very well. The carriage is over here.
Roosevelt pointed toward the rather large and very elegant carriage that sat just off the end of the depot platform.
Oh, my. That's quite a lovely conveyance. I've seen similar conveyances in New York, but I don't believe I've ever seen one out here.
I must confess to being a bit of a dandy in some areas. While I love the ruggedness of this wonderful West, I do like a few of the creature comforts. And this carriage, I am afraid, is one of my vanities.
A vanity I shall enjoy.